Hello and welcome, friends, to another edition of Sustainability Now with me, Justin Mogg, your host right here on Forward Radio. We broadcast to you from high atop the historic Habern Building at 106.5 FM. We also live stream anywhere you are in the world. You can always pick up Forward Radio's live stream at forwardradio.org. While you're there, become a part of this station. This is radio for the people, by the people. And we need more people involved in the station to keep us going strong into our seventh year. Coming up on April 9th, we'll be marking 7 years on the air. Thanks to you all chipping in as volunteers behind the scenes, behind the microphones, doing one-time access hours, whatever. Also chipping in financially. It is all listener sponsored and it's really affordable. What a great community resource for only $20 a day. We cover all the costs of this volunteer powered station. So you could probably sponsor this day's broadcast right now at forwardradio.org. And now is the time to do it because we are in the last week of our seventh anniversary pledge drive and we absolutely need your support to reach our goal of raising $7,000 by this Saturday, April 13th. We're chugging along and with your help, we can make it. Give whatever you can and only this week, you can pick up on some fabulous thank you items. Sport your Forward Radio pride with a t-shirt, a long sleeve hoodie, or bumper sticker, or you can get your message shout it out right here on Forward Radio just by making a contribution today. Go to forwardradio.org and click on that red button to donate to our pledge drive now. Well, as you know, what we do each week on this show is we sit down with wonderful folks from around the community to discuss what they're up to in sustainability. And I am so excited today to finally, you know, Nick, we've been wanting to do this for a long time. Finally sit down with Nick Palowitz, who is U of L's professor of communication and author of a brand new book that's just out called Extraction Politics, Rio Tinto and the Corporate Persona. It's out from Penn State Press as part of a series in transdisciplinary rhetoric. Nick, welcome to Forward Radio.
Thanks so much, Justin.
Yeah.
I'm so happy to be here. And I just want to say generally, like, what you do is amazing. Like, with the University of Louisville and, like,
you.
With this radio program and being here at the Habern Building.
Yeah.
This is just awesome sustainability stuff. So thank you so much for what you do and for having me on the air.
Oh, thank you, Nick. It is always a pleasure every time I get to chat with you on campus or off. And I've really been enjoying diving into your book. It is such a treat to actually be able to sit down and have a conversation about extraction. And the reason I say that, Nick, is because anytime I'm trying to break down what's unsustainable about our society, I mean, there's so many things we could point to, right? But I'm always just trying to make it simple for people. Like, what is at the root of our unsustainable living? And of course, fossil fuels are there, but they're part of what is really at the root, which is an extractive economy.
Yeah.
And I'm always trying to give people solutions on this show that help us do less extraction by living more local with the resources that are already here that are truly renewable, right? So I'm so grateful that you took the time to write this book, Nick, and focus on this topic. Has it been something that's been like needling you for years that you wanted to work on?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I've been working on this project for more or less, like, I swear, like 10 to 15 years.
Really?
I mean, the seeds for this project really began when I was earning my PhD at the University of Utah.
Oh.
If you're familiar, there's the massive Bingham Canyon mine right outside
of town. I didn't know you had a Utah connection.
Yeah,
that's making a lot of sense all of a sudden.
So that's where all this pretty much got started. You know, I got there, you know, from Central Michigan University, you know, here to get my PhD in environmental communication. And so I'm thinking of things to write about. I know I'm interested in global climate change and argumentation and sustainability. And, you know, I look outside my window and see this massive hole. And I swear to God, for the first week that I was in Salt Lake, you know, I had this tiny little apartment that's probably about the size of this office here. And just looking out there towards the Uinta Mountains and thinking, what the heck is going on out there?
Literally, you could see the mine from your apartment.
Yeah, you could see the mine from my apartment. And, you know, at night is when it was really sort of like illuminated because they had the lights on, you know, because the mine never closes. It never stops. They're working 24 hours.
And this is open pit. This isn't Kentucky down in the coal mine.
Oh, no, this is open pit.
This is open pit.
Which says something, and we can maybe talk a little bit about this later, but it says, I think, something about kind of like where we are exactly, like in this sort of extractive regime, I guess, or this extractive moment, you know, where we have to... We have to do open pit mining to extract this stuff because large vein deposits of rare earth minerals like copper or cadmium or nickel or whatever,
palladium,
stuff's all gone.
Yeah.
You know, and so really the only way to get this stuff from like mountain to like cell phone or to like computer is to do open pit mining, where like literally 98%, if not more, of the stuff that they extract is just waste.
Right.
And the rest of it through porphyry open pit mining methods is, you know, refined and smelted and it goes through this highly technological process to get you this purified stuff. So what that really means is that there's a tremendous amount of waste. Like 98% of that, you know, mountain is gone. I mean, it's just, you know, these tailing sites at different parts of the country. And so.
And toxic waste.
Yeah, for sure. Highly toxic waste.
We don't really know what to do with it.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And we're going to go to the Southwest a lot in this conversation. But before we do, I want to make it as relevant to our listeners as possible. So what does the extraction economy look like in Kentucky? We don't really have as many rare earth minerals, right? But it's pointing back to this history of coal mining. And another piece of it that's come in more recently is the issue of fracking for natural gas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's all part of this extractive economy, as you say, different kinds of extraction, different methods. And I think, you know, one of the things that's important to pay attention to when we're talking about different kinds of extraction is, of course, the communities that are affected by this.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And the different discourses surrounding these sites, you know, and affects as well, right? I mean, so you have persons and communities that have, you know, legacies attached to particular mines and things like that. And then, of course, the devastation that comes from these different mines that are either open pit mines or underground mines. So, yeah, so all part of this extractive economy, but, you know, different communities give these different mines and sites of extraction different kinds of feels.
And it translates right to our politics, right? We're in a moment right now during the Kentucky legislature where they passed a bill to make it more difficult to retire coal-fired power plants in Kentucky. And the reason for that is tied all the way back to this legacy of coal mining in Kentucky, and our legislators can't seem to let it go and look to a future where we don't have to rely on such an extractive economy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing to me.
Yeah.
it's just plainly amazing to me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm just sort of thinking about these differences and similarities between, like, coal and copper, right? And so in some ways, I think that coal is more under the limelight, right? There's like a heightened degree of criticism towards, I think, coal and coal communities.
Because
and like
of the climate change.
Because of the climate change crisis. And so I think what that does is that kind of deflects.
We're literally feeling it.
Yeah.
Whereas copper...
Exactly, right? It sort of it deflects from the realities of these like sustainability sort of futures that are, you know, like solar panels and geothermal, basically any kind of sustainability sort of technology you can think of has some kind of copper in it.
Yeah.
You know, and so we need to be talking about copper and like the environmental impacts of that.
Yes.
Obviously coal as well, but, you know, it's just different. It's a different kind of politic.
Yeah. We're going to have you read the opening page in a minute, but before we get there, I wanted to ask, too, because I knew that in 2020 and 21, you were a Bingham Faculty Fellow with the Commonwealth Center for the Humanities and Society, and that year was focused on the Anthropocene, environment, and modernity. Was this book project part of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Boy, that organization is so awesome. Like, if any of those CCHS fellows are listening, like, you guys are awesome. Like, thanks so much. Like, John Gibson and, like, these different interdisciplinary fellows. It was so awesome getting together via Zoom at the time, this, you know, COVID time.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Just talking about this stuff. But, boy, the ideas that came from that group was really generative of this project.
I am glad to hear that. Yeah, it does seem like these kinds of projects are so much better in collaboration.
Yeah, for sure. And humanities. Yeah, go humanities, you know?
Exactly. I love it.
Yeah, so I had that. That was all year. And then the next fall, I was on sabbatical. And so that's I really wrote this book. And during that summer, that's when I traveled to these different mines in Salt Lake City, in Boron, California, and in Superior, Arizona, at the Troubled Oak Flat mine.
I definitely want to ask you about those travels. But maybe a good way to continue this conversation is for you to read a little bit from the text. I know you wanted to sort of open it up for us with this introduction. The corporation that therefore I am.
Yeah, so that title is kind of a play on Descartes, right? And his cogito, you know, I think therefore I am. And so, yeah, I'm glad you like that title. That's awesome.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the title itself is kind of like argumentative about like what corporations and corporate personhood sort of says about us, right, as humans, right, in this extractive moment and where we're all assemblages. So anyways, okay, so I'll just read a couple of pages. President Ronald Reagan was not quite himself when he delivered the annual Churchill Lecture at London's famous Guildhall in the summer of 1989. If he had Alzheimer's disease at that time, it did not show. Reagan was absent in other ways. Mainly, for the purposes of this monograph, he spoke, and not for the first time, as a corporate persona. In the past, Reagan played various roles in vintage ads for General Electric, Union Pacific, Chesterfield Cigarettes, and Royal Crown Cola, but this time he sponsored a more discreet, but no less ubiquitous company in his promotion of the democratic possibilities of the microchip, an international mining company called Rio Tinto.
Mm.
Advancing Rio Tinto's extractivist interests throughout the world, and especially in the American Southwest, Reagan strategically used mineral-bearing technologies as seemingly neutral realpolitik matters of fact to bridge troubled waters between the East and West. Technology was dubbed the oxygen of the modern age, and communication technology was Reagan's weapon for transcending the United States' entrenched divisions with the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. The Goliath of totalitarian control will rapidly be brought down by the David of the microchip, he said, before an audience of about 1,000 hosted by the English-speaking Union. Reagan may not have mentioned Rio Tinto by name, but this Geist-like corporation was, intentionally or not, one of the main benefactors of his speech, and it could not have missed the relevance of the speech to its global operations. Mm. Rio Tinto was present subjectively through Reagan as an implied corporate network that would carry out Reagan's implicit calls for heightened extractivism to create the technology needed for global peace and prosperity. After all, Rio Tinto's global headquarters were located just down the street from Guildhall in London's mining financial district.
Wow. London has a mining financial district,
oh,
right?
Heck yeah.
Heck yeah, I want to ask you about that visit too. But first, I love that you took us back to the 80s, the Reagan era. And you know where that sent my mind? Was in the 90s, Nick. We were out on the streets protesting globalization, right? And at that time, I hadn't, you know, really got an understanding of sustainability, sustainable development, whatever. I didn't understand that this extractive economy was really at the root of all the problems. I just knew that, you know, this meant we're going to lose jobs to places where there are more lax environmental laws or worker regulations, right? And there was a really strong movement against globalization. That movement was not ultimately successful, right? And globalization has been going apace since then, since Reagan era, right? And that has really amped up the impact of this problematic extractive economy, right? Do you tackle globalization in your book, or have you thought about that as part of the roots of this global crisis here?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I mean, Rio Tinto, importantly, is this international actor. I mean, it's this, like, Leviathan. You know, this, like, it's this global colonial assemblage, right? And yes, I love this perspective that you bring in, Justin, about, like, the world of globalization. I'm thinking of the 1999 Battle for Seattle,
exactly,
right? And sort of the consequences of that, you know, in terms of, like, mass media, too, right? As sort of something that's worked in conjunction or tandem of this, you know, globalized empire or whatnot.
Yeah.
But yeah, Rio Tinto is this global colonial assemblage, and it's not by accident that its headquarters is in London. I mean, think of the British Empire, right?
Yes.
And so, of course, it has like its financial district has like this extractive sort of headquarters. It's like, I mean, extraction always had everything to do with colonialism and vice versa, right? So colonialism, global colonialism has always been rooted in different kinds of extraction. And so, yeah, so it's no accident that in today's empire, it's all rooted in extraction, right?
Yeah.
Especially in this world of mass mediated communication.
Right, right.
Screens and whatnot.
There's this intertwined problematic nature of colonialism and extraction and extractive economy, which, you know, today we're talking about mining, but, you know, when this country was founded, we were talking about people, right? Extracting slaves from Africa, right? So it's really highly problematic, and we need to talk about where this started. But before we do, I just need to break in for a second and remind everybody that you are tuned into a very special Pledge Drive edition of Sustainability Now here on Forward Radio. This program is only coming to you because of your dedicated support over the entire 7-year run of this show and this station. station, if you love what you're hearing, if you know you can't get it anywhere else, then we need you to go to forwardradio.org right now. Click the red button at the top. Donate to our pledge drive. In exchange, just through this Saturday, you can pick up on some wonderful thank you items and wear your Forward Radio pride with you wherever you go. And then join us on Saturday. We're going to have our 7th birthday party from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Logan Street Market, and you can support us some more by picking up some great silent auction items, including 2 beautiful hard copy versions of this book we're talking about today, Extraction Politics by U of L's Nick Palowitz. And enjoying Charles Booker, we're going to pipe in our friends from East Leeds Community Radio in our sister city in Leeds, England. We're going to have dancing and cake. You won't want to miss it, my friends. Come on down this Saturday, 5 o'clock at Logan Street Market. And I just want to reintroduce you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Sustainability Now. You are in for such a treat as we speak with Nick Palowitz. He's a professor of communication at the University of Louisville, author of the brand new book, Extraction Politics, Rio Tinto and the Corporate Persona. But this comes on the heels of 3 books I failed to mention at the start of the show. The Securitization of Memorial Space, Rhetoric and Public Memory. How cool is that? Racial Terrorism, A Rhetorical Investigation of Lynching. And Memory and Monument Wars in American Cities, New York, Charlottesville, and Montgomery. So please dive into the full canon of Nick Palowitz. And he is on LinkedIn if you want to get connected and get links to those other works. But I was thinking in my mind as we were talking about, well, going back to the 80s or the Battle for Seattle, can we even point to a time when this extraction politics, extraction economy began? or is it always been a part of... as long as economy has existed.
Yeah, pretty much. The latter. I mean, I want to say like pre-industrial, like agrarian communities were less extractive and like maybe, but I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at, for instance, at the river in, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Huelva, Spain, where Rio Tinto gets its name.
Yeah.
And it's named after, Rio Tinto is the Red River. And the reason why it's the Red River is because it's been so stinking contaminated since the Roman Empire.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so even back then, right, the Romans were extracting this site for lead and for copper and whatever. And I think it's also sort of telling about, you know, symbolically, you know, where Rio Tinto sort of gets its name from. I mean, there's a picture of it in the book. It doesn't quite do justice because it's in black.
Oh, I wish
it
was a color book. Yeah.
I know. I thought that too. You know, I'm posting because you look at it. I mean, if any of you listeners are out there and like on your computer, whatever, Google the Rio Tinto River in Spain and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's amazing. This river is
bleeding.
It's bleeding. It's bright red.
Acid mine.
And that's where Rio Tinto gets its name from. Although it is a British company, it was originally a Spanish company in like the 18th century or whatever. Oh. And what's also amazing about this place is that they have turned it into a tourist attraction. And I think that's
come
sort
and
of
see
telling.
The pollution,
yeah,
everybody.
And so I think that's sort of telling. But it's not like come see the pollution. It's like, hey, come take these rides
really?
And come visit these old ancient mines and take this little roller coaster and buy like this merchandise that celebrates this extractive past.
Oh my God!
And so that's kind of where rhetoric comes in,
yeah,
right. And sort of like the rhetorical strategies and rhetorical framings that Rio Tinto and other sort of corporate actors use in order to like to talk to make meaning or make sense of these otherwise devastating places. And so I talk about it in the book as an example of like alchemy, right? So where Rio Tinto is an example of how different companies, especially extractive companies, draw from place-based resources in order to turn these resources into like gold, into like golden realities.
Wow.
And so it's kind of like alchemy, right? Where you're turning like lead or whatever into gold. And so Rio Tinto, which mines copper, does the same sort of thing at these different places that it extracts, and not least of which is at the Rio Tinto in Spain, where it's turning, you know, it's an example of this, of where Rio Tinto has turned this devastating environmental place, right, that Lord Byron was once complaining about hundreds of years ago, into this amusement park. Like, that's sort of the alchemy of Rio Tinto, and that's the rhetoric.
Oh my goodness.
That it sort of uses to do all this stuff.
So, this book is a lot about corporate personhood and the problems of that, which I guess we often think of in the U.S. context as, you know, pointing the finger at the Supreme Court in the United States for granting corporate personhood or something, but it actually is a global issue, right? So tell us the story of your efforts to try and therefore meet Rio Tinto. I mean, if Rio Tinto has personhood, then surely it is something you can meet, right?
That's such a great question. I want to thank you so much for that. Because, like, methodologically, that's kind of what's happening in this book. Like,
approaching
Rio Tinto as this sort of corporate person and my travels to these different sites of extraction is absolutely motivated by this sort of, like, inquiry or, like, this desire to meet or encounter Rio Tinto.
Let's go shake hands with Rio Tinto.
So that's kind of what I was doing, you know, in the American Southwest. These questions began when I was in grad school at the University of Utah because the Bingham Canyon mine is right there. The largest hole on the planet.
Is it really?
Yeah, it really is.
The largest.
Largest hole on the planet. And so that's
can you give us a sense of scale? How large is it?
Oh, man. You know, who does a really good job at this is Rio Tinto because this is how they sort of like
market
or brand the place or like, talk about it as like you can fit like 3 Eiffel Towers in here.
It's
so large you can see it from outer space. You know, this and the Great Wall of China are the largest man-made sort of things on the planet. It's true. I mean, if you encounter that mine, I mean, you'll get a sense for the scale. It is just, it's amazing. It's sublime.
Yeah.
So they have like this visitors platform at the top of the mine where visitors can go.
They welcome people. Wow.
Yeah. And doing that for the first time as a graduate student, it's like, okay, this is what I'm interested in. This is unbelievable.
Wow.
So just the sense of scale. I mean, it is just, it's an abyss. You know, it's actually that encounter is the opening for chapter one.
Okay.
And it's sort of like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Totally, utterly sublime.
And I assume you visited the Grand Canyon as well.
I have not.
You haven't? Okay, I was
going to
ask
Canyon,
how they
actually
compare.
I need to go to the Grand Canyon. But I've been past it and through it, you know, on various ventures. But yeah, it might be comparable to that.
I did want to ask specifically, like, what was the feeling when you first encountered this mine? There's a feeling of awe, but then other feelings rush in, right? Terror.
I mean, it's terrifying. Mm. I mean, like, I'm not one that gets vertigo very easily, you know, like, I scrambled up countless mountains and whatever, but boy, being there and confronting that is just, it's terrifying.
Mm.
Like, what have we done?
Mm.
How did this happen?
Yeah.
You know, and so the vicissitudes of sort of absence, I think, are relevant or metonymic, sort of representative of the absences of the Earth in what we now call the Anthropocene, right? And so, like, the mind tells you everything you need to know about this idea of the Anthropocene, which is, for listeners not aware, it's like this, you know, it's this global geological epoch defined by humans' irrevocable, irredeemable impacts on planet Earth. And what better example of that is there than the Bingham Canyon mine?
Yeah, we're talking about, like, if geologists way in the future come to look back, and we always say alien geologists, right? They'll dig down through the layers, they'll see these things called dinosaurs, right? But they'll also see evidence of humans' impact on the landscape, and certainly the mine, the Bingham Canyon mine outside Salt Lake City will be unmissable, right? It's so massive. But even now, as I think about things like we hear about microplastics being found in every corner of the world, in every placenta, and in every soil, right? Like, so there's no doubt that certainly plastics are going to be there. But this is really on a terrifying scale, and most people probably don't see it, right? Most people aren't familiar with Rio Tinto, right?
That's it. Yeah. And that's the thing. That's why this kind of work, I think, anyways, is so important.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how many of you think about your copper or nickel or palladium that's in your cell phone that you're using to, you know, text your friend or whatever, or, you know, right now that we're using to communicate this message, right? It's so copper, like Rio Tinto, I mean, these are invisible forces, right? It's like the mine itself, which is oftentimes in, like, the hinterlands and far away from society, which I think is what makes the Bingham Canyon mine so unique. It's propinquity to Salt Lake City. It's how the proximity.
To
city. So this relationship between city and, like, hinterland is really powerful. It's really intricate in Salt Lake City in particular because the mine is part of society there.
Wow.
Whereas most mines are, like, you know, in northern Canada or the Arctic or whatever, far, you know, the Mojave Desert. This is right there. And so what that does for Rio Tinto is it creates a rhetorical situation for them to make sense of this mine. So here is this massive hole that persons see literally every single day in Salt Lake City. And Rio Tinto has some rhetorical work that needs to be done, right, in order to make meaning of that mine to society and to, I mean, their goal is to make it mundane, right? So that sense of terror that I had, you know, as, you know, for that first time visiting the mine, other people see that very differently, especially those that are, you know, from the Valley or in Utah. Who have been trained, right, to see that mine as a hallmark of society and civilization and, you know, building the modern sort of empire, not modern society, whatever.
Yeah.
And so... So yeah, so the massive absence of that whole sort of, it shows us like how much rhetorical work needs to be done by Rio Tinto to make sense of that mine, among others.
When you say rhetorical work, that's, you know, for a lot of our listeners, that's going to feel like it's kind of egg-heady talking. What's he talking about there?
Sorry,
I'm not trying to insult you at all. I'm just saying. Most people call that PR, right?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Yeah, no, you're right. That's a great question. So rhetoric is just like a fancy word for saying, like, well, persuasion.
Yeah.
So what are the different modes of persuasion that Rio Tinto, as this sort of global colonial actor, is using in order to make sense of its mind? So think of rhetoric as like the meaning-making sort of powers of an individual, you know, in any given moment. So like the
stories
uses,
that are told.
Yeah, and the use of all of the available means of persuasion. That's that's Aristotle's definition.
So
persuasion. Yeah, but PR is part of this too and all this. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so we were going to tell the story of meeting Rio Tinto, and one way you did that is by going to the mine, but you also went to their corporate headquarters, right?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about, what's that like?
Wow. Well, it was kind of by accident, to be honest.
Really? You stumbled on it?
Yeah, I was... I mean, of course, I was working on Rio Tinto at the time.
No, this probably wasn't as fun as when I was on a bike tour in Vermont and we stumbled upon the Ben & Jerry's factory.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, we're like, all right, ice cream tour.
That's amazing.
No, this is different.
Well, I was actually in Europe because I was at an argumentation conference in Amsterdam. It's the International Study for Society of Argumentation, yada, yada. And I was there with my wife and we're like, well, we want to go to London. Never been there before.
Yeah.
And of course, in the back of my mind, you know, I know that Rio Tinto headquarters is there, and so it's sort of like a side trip from that argumentation conference. And so we got there, and that was a whole story because I think we had too much fun in Amsterdam and we missed our flight, and so we had to take this bus through the night and under the English Channel, and that was a trip. But anyway, so we get there, and yeah, you know, I see Rio Tinto on the map, you know, so I take the tube, you know, to this financial district, and I look for Rio Tinto, and it's what's amazing about it is how mundane this sort of office is. It's in a swanky part of town for sure, but it's not like what I sort of had in mind as like, I don't know, think of Rio Tinto's global headquarters. I think of like, you know, this global Alcazar, you know, you'll be able to see from miles away, but it was very mundane.
Huh.
And it was
really subtle nameplate. I saw the photo, right?
Uh-huh. Like, so it says Rio Tinto. And so I'm like, all right, well, I'll just walk on it. That's exactly what.
And how were you welcomed?
You know, they were actually surprisingly nice and very friendly and like jovial. And like, hey, what's up, guys? And I'm like, and I'm just asking these dorky, you know, academic questions like, hey, you know, can I get a tour? what's going on here? You know, of course, it's all financial stuff anyway. So offices and whatever, but they wouldn't let me, you know, pass the main office. But, you know, I just got a sense for like how Rio Tinto operates and how it sort of works.
Yeah.
You know? So this is the global sort of headquarters of this place. And it's just like pretty innocuous. But of course, it has financial headquarters in like Melbourne and other places as well. But I think it's also sort of a testament for how Rio Tinto operates as an assemblage.
Yeah.
And that's a fancy word for saying like Rio Tinto is like a network.
Uh-huh.
It's a networky thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the centralized sort of thing or place that exists, you know, like a, I don't know, like a medieval castle does or whatever, you know. It's on countless different places all at once. I mean, it's on like 60 different countries.
Is
has
it
mines
really?
On 60 different countries on every continent except Antarctica.
Wow.
And so visiting its headquarters is just visiting one sort of module or one node of this assemblage. So to really sort of encounter or get to know Rio Tinto, you have to visit these mines.
Wow.
And so that's what I did in the American Southwest. And given this is just like three mines of like 60 or so, but it did give me a sense for how Rio Tinto manages its identity at these mines in the United States. And so how does it adapt its identity to these different places and spaces while also being distantly removed in London? And so answering that question is a way of kind of understanding how extractive colonialism works.
Yeah.
How these different extractive colonial organizations and corporations not only extract and blow up these communities, right, for copper or coal or whatever, but also how they manage their presences and their identities at these different places. So you go to these places in the American Southwest, that Boron, at Salt Lake, at Superior, and Rio Tinto seems like one of the locals. You know,
just another guy at the bar. That's the,
it's like we're one of you, you know. So this is how it sort of does that rhetorical work by drawing from the different local resources and meanings and histories or whatever, and adapting itself to place in powerful ways.
Yeah, this is such a fascinating conversation. You're listening to Nick Palowitz. He is a professor of communication at U of L. I've been trying to get him in the studio for a long time now. His book has finally come out. We're so excited. Encourage you to check out Extraction Politics, Rio Tinto, and the Corporate Persona. And you can pick up a beautiful hardcover version of Nick's book at our silent auction. That's going to be a wonderful part of our 7th birthday party coming up on Saturday, April 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Logan Street Market. This will be the very last day of our 7th anniversary pledge drive, which we hope you will go to fordradio.org right now to support. Give whatever you can. Pick up some great thank you gifts. Help us reach $7,000 for 7 years at fordradio.org. I wanted to ask you something at the beginning, and I didn't have a chance, so let me do it now. One thing I like to ask authors is about the people they dedicate their books to. So you have dedicated this book to, and I hope I pronounce it right, Yithrang Nongbri.
Yeah.
Who is Yithrang?
That is Yithrang.
Yithrang. Thank you.
Yithrang Nongbri. That's my father-in-law.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's my my wife's dad, who passed away recently while I was working on this book.
Yeah.
And he's from, and my wife is from, northeastern India, in the state of Meghalaya in Shillong. And well, there's a lot of extraction that's going on up there in the northeast by different kinds of companies that are targeting this land for its hard rock minerals. And he was just an amazing guy and sort of like at the fore of all this sort of stuff. And it's a tribal community as well. So it's part of this. I don't want to like say it's like part of this legacy of extracting precious mineral metals from indigenous communities, but kind of.
Yeah,
you know? So that goes to Katao, which is Kasi for father-in-law.
All right. Presente, we would say in South America. Yeah, excellent. Thanks for sharing that. So there's a phrase you use in the book that I'd love for you to unpack for me and our listeners, because I'm just a dumb monkey. I don't know what this is. I haven't studied rhetoric or even communication, even though I do it all the time, right? You use a phrase called strategic essentialism. What is that?
Boy, well, that is a concept that comes from Spivak. As you may know. And so she was a Derridian, right? A deconstructionalist. I know it's lots of fancy talk.
Yeah.
And so we don't need to get into the deconstructive weeds with Spivak's philosophy. But let's see, in terms of, well, in the context of Rio Tinto, strategic essentialism is my way of talking about how different communities that are affected by Rio Tinto's extractive sort of regime fight back.
Yeah.
And so what it is, basically, is it is how different communities essentialize Rio Tinto as a polluter or as a sort of genocidal actor or essentially this or essentially that in sort of a bad connotative way. And so that is one way of speaking back, if you will, to Rio Tinto, because otherwise Rio Tinto wants you to think like it's your good neighbor.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
And it's many different things. So one of the sort of rhetorical affordances that Rio Tinto has that comes from it being this global assemblage that's at many different places all at once is it allows it to rhetorically and argumentatively shift.
Oh.
Right? So think about even like the legal problems or difficulties of trying to hold Rio Tinto accountable in Salt Lake City, for instance, for its possible sort of genocide that's happening in other parts of the world or in Oak Flat. Are we dealing with the same corporation or with a different corporation?
Yeah.
So these are questions of another fancy turgid word, ontology, right?
And what's that?
so that's a fancy word for being. So we're understanding Rio Tinto's being or like how it actually exists in the world. That's all that word means. Yeah, and so Rio Tinto's ontology is a shifty one because it's an assemblage.
Yeah.
It's able to maneuver in and out of different sort of argumentative and subjective positions. And so one way different rhetorical communities can and have spoken back is trying to essentialize Rio Tinto to basically hold it accountable.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
For its singular actions in different places.
So it sounds like strategic essentialism can be used for good or bad, right? It sounds like maybe something Trump does a lot, but also like you can either lionize something like a Rio Tinto corporation or you can demonize it, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess if we want to be serious about sustainability, we need to avoid that because the true situation is very complicated. And the solutions, a way out is going to be complicated too, right?
Yeah, it is complicated. And I think it's important to sort of to work through that complexity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As both a community actor and also as a critic on local and global sort of scale. So yeah, it is also something that corporations use themselves.
Okay, yeah.
For sure, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Trump, I think, is a really great example of this. And I don't really want to talk about that guy, but take us in totally different directions. But yeah, you know, corporation, I mean, so Rio Tinto is kind of like representative of corporate personhood, right? And how corporations exist in the world. Because it's this global thing that's at many different places all at once. I mean, think about like Coca-Cola, for instance. Coca-Cola is right at the grocery store. It's at, you know, these different factories. It's also in like every other country in the world
all at once.
Really. So trying to follow that logo or brand all at once gives you an idea of the complexity of that. And so Coca-Cola, like sort of Rio Tinto, as corporate sort of persons or actors, are forced to like essentialize their own beings or identities to like pass. As you know, as a corporate person or like your good neighbor or whatever. And so what that means for sustainability, I think, is, well, is to recognize, like you say, that this is just more complex than we think. Coca-Cola or Rio Tinto wants us to think of their corporate identities as the singular thing that's sort of like benevolent for society. But it's this global extractive thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we need to think about the costs of extraction and the different sort of environmental effects that go into that sort of branding or identity.
And I don't want to be essentialist about it necessarily. There's good things happening here, but I want to talk about the world of corporate sustainability, right? A lot of corporations, probably even Rio Tinto, have sustainability initiatives, right? And and some of that work is really, really great and important, but it can also be used to greenwash, basically, right? So did you encounter that at all in your research of the book or with other projects where you're dealing with this corporate sustainability issue?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. This book is very much informed and in conversation with all of the rich work in communication studies that has talked about different kinds of greenwashing, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's happening everywhere with Rio Tinto and with other corporations and extractive industries. And so, I mean, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter, though, is that Rio Tinto, although I'm sort of, you know, this is a criticism of Rio Tinto, this whole book, you know, but the truth is that there are companies that are a lot worse than Rio Tinto.
Yep.
A lot worse. And so this is kind of like back to the Bingham Canyon mine in particular and its relationship with Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Right. We said earlier that what's unique about the Bingham Canyon mine is that it's so close to Salt Lake City, whereas most mines are distantly removed from society and nobody ever has to see it. Nobody ever has to think about it. And they just go on with their days. Right. That's rooted in different levels of extraction, whatever. In Salt Lake City, it's right there, so you can't miss it.
Yeah.
So what that means for Rio Tinto is that it's forced to sort of step up its sustainability game because it knows that communities are watching.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of, I think, the benefits from a sustainability perspective of either having mines close to society or just like generally being aware of these, you know, getting communities involved in the meaning of these different sites of extraction.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me that in that case in Salt Lake, they're not only willing but eager to have people come check it out, whereas I don't know if Rio Tinto is involved in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, probably, right? Yeah. But the type of mining operations that are happening there, you know, it's not this sort of technological marvel. It's people in poverty rushing in doing, you know, this small scale mining with sometimes with their bare hands and being crushed under collapses of, you know, these mines and sort of suffering directly from the toxins and, you know, really just, you know, awful, awful modern conditions of slavery, basically, where people have no other economic option there. And I can't imagine that Rio Tinto would want to show that face to the world, right? Or whatever corporation is in charge of those mines there. So it's interesting that the ways it looks differently in different places in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. You know, so I'm just thinking of what you said about the Congo, of a really great book.
Oh, good.
Written a couple of years ago that readers may also be interested in. It's called Eyes of the World.
Yeah.
Like that Grateful Dead song.
That's great.
And love, right? But Eyes of the World, it's about local hands-on cobalt mining in the
yes,
Congo.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And small scale, and how essential that is to that phone that's blowing up right now.
Whatever. Right, right.
But yeah, per your point, like these mines look very differently in different parts of the world. So yeah, so Rio Tinto wants a mine that it can sort of put on this pillar and be like, this is what sustainability looks like.
Yeah.
This is what we need as sort of this, you know, modern country, you know, whatever, moving into the 21st century.
Good job.
Yeah, good job. Yeah. And so that's what it wants to do with the Bingham Canyon mine. I think it does a pretty good job of that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
per your point, that is not representative of all the other, however many mines there are in the world in different places that don't have the same sort of political, social, or legal structures in societies that hold those companies accountable.
This time has flown by as usual. We just have a few minutes left. This has been so great. I'm glad we've taken the time to really try and connect people who are living in the modern technosphere, right? Like it's all around us. We can't escape it. And connecting that technosphere directly to the earth and to the atmosphere, there are just so many minerals that we don't even think about that these companies, these corporate persons, are bringing to us every day, and I'm so glad for this book to reveal it. But then there's other things you this book isn't about them, but you mentioned them. There's new forms of mining, right? There is data mining. There is mining for Bitcoin, right? These two, even though they don't exist on the planet directly, they're not mines into the earth. They are still threatening our collective future, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, so like our extractive economy isn't just like a material process, although it's that too, but it's also generative of different sort of like metaphors that we use, right? When we talk about different things that we're doing. Communication, right? And so, yeah, so like data mining is a great example of that. It's like, you know, it's a metaphor for extraction, for doing this sort of thing. And, you know, and it's also extraction. To extract something is metaphoric for so many other things, right? As a method and also as a practice. And I think that's sort of reflective of, well, of the force of this extractive sort of machine, right? And how its ideological underpinning is what it is, right? How it's sort of affected like our psyche as like Americans in like the 21st century and like these pioneers of progress are like moving into the future through sustainability, right? And that's fine, but we just need to be aware of like the material environmental effects of actual extraction. And so the sort of practices, ecological practices, that those metaphors might be, contributing to is what we sort of need to be cognizant of.
Yep.
Because otherwise, things like copper are just, they're invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Extraction is this invisible sort of thing where people aren't aware of the costs. And one of the goals of this book is to make copper and Rio Tinto and this extractive economy more visible.
Mm. I'm so grateful for it. Friends, if you were out on the streets in the Battle of Seattle or down in Miami with me fighting against the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which I guess we won on in 2000, I think that was. If you're a younger person concerned about our global collective future, you should check out Nick Palowitz's brand new book, Extraction Politics, Rio Tinto and the Corporate Persona. It is a very important text, and I'm so grateful, Nick, that you took the time to pull it all together for us. I know a book is a massive project.
Thanks so much, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. It was so great to have you here. We'll have to get you back again. Thank you, Nick. Stay tuned, everybody. Coming up in just a second, I've got your community action calendar. Yes, there's a bunch of ways you can dig into sustainability right now this week, right here in Louisville, including your chance to pick up a hard copy of Nick's brand new book, Extraction Politics, coming up just this week, so stay tuned.
Just a little bit of love, just a little bit of love, just a little bit of love, just a little bit of love. No me cierre la puerta, no me cierre la puerta de tu corazón, no me cierre la puerta.
And we are back. back here on Sustainability Now with me, Justin Mogg. I hope you've got your calendars out, your pencils sharpened, you're ready to take action for sustainability this week. Well, first of all, we need your help sustaining this station. If you love programming like this and recognize that you can't get it anywhere else, we need you to go to forwardradio.org right now. Become a member of the station. Contribute to our pledge drive. It runs through Saturday, April 13th, when we're going to be having our big party celebrating 7 years on the air. We hope you'll join us for that too. It is at Logan Street Market from 5 to 8 p.m. It is free. Donations will be accepted, of course, but we'll also be having a wonderful silent auction on Saturday with tons of really great items, including two copies of the book we were just discussing by my guest, Nick Palowitz. So come on out Saturday, 5 to 8 p.m. for Forward Radio's 7th birthday party at the Logan Street Market. But right now, we need you to go to forwardradio.org, click that big red button at the top, and contribute whatever you can to help us reach our goal of $7,000 to mark 7 years on the air. This is the money we need to simply pay the bills so that the volunteers can come to the station and do the work they do to bring you voices and ideas and concepts and calendars you won't hear anywhere else. So what else is happening this week? Well, Trees Louisville is looking for some volunteers to help plant trees this week. If you're interested in helping out, all you got to do is email Morgan at treeslouisville.org. This Tuesday, April 9th, they'll be planting 25 new street trees out at 13th and Market Street from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. And then on Wednesday, the 10th, they'll be out at Petersburg Road from 2 to 4. And they need your help planting 40 trees. Now, the holes will already be augured, so it'll be easier than digging into fresh ground. But that's Wednesday, 2 to 4 at Petersburg Road. And then Saturday, April 13th, it's Tree Fest at Petersburg Park. I'll have more about that in just a minute, but there'll be opportunities to volunteer all day, and you can learn more about that at treeslouisville.org/treefest. Also on Tuesday the 9th in the evening, it is a Discover Co-Housing presentation going to take place at the main library in the Centennial Room, 301 York Street at 6 p.m. If you heard Mayor Greenberg's press conference back on March 20th, you may have noticed that he gave a shout out to Louisville Co-Housing. The mayor talked about affordable housing right here in Louisville, highlighting human stories and the final draft of his My Louisville Home Plan for 15,000 new affordable residential units by 2027. Well, on this Tuesday evening, Louisville Co-Housing will be hosting a presentation at which Matilda Berthick, co-housing designer and founder of Studio Cohab, will be sharing an in-depth presentation about co-housing. And Marilyn Harris, director of housing and community development with Louisville Metro, will also be speaking about the My Louisville Home Plan and a section that has been added about co-housing. So come if you want to learn more about Louisville Co-Housing. And of course, you can always check out their website to learn more at louisvillecohousing.com. Now, on Wednesday, April 10th, the Louisville Nature Center is hosting a workshop on Backyard Chickens 101, 5:30 to 7 p.m. Are you ready to increase your flock? Well, get started by attending this program and learn the basics of raising backyard chickens. You can learn more and get your tickets at louisvillenaturecenter.org. A little later, 6 p.m. on Wednesday, April 10th, the Speed Art Museum will be hosting the Brianna Taylor Lecture on Structural Inequality with Damon Hewitt, President and Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. He will present Democracy Forward, Advocacy, Empowerment, and Inclusion. The recipients of the Daryl T. Owens Community Service Award and Brianna Taylor Legacy Fellowships will also be announced. The event is sponsored by the UofL Brandeis School of Law and is free and open to the public Wednesday, April 10th, 6 p.m. at the Speed Art Museum. You can learn more at louisville.edu/sustainability. Now, if you want it more casual, Green Drinks is happening also on Wednesday the 10th at 6 p.m. Hosted by the Louisville Sustainability Council. This month, they're going to be out at the Cafe at Paristown, 731 Brent Street. And this month, you can come learn about Brown-Forman's sustainability initiatives as they kick off their sponsorship of the 2024 Green Drinks Series. You can learn more about this fun, casual, green networking event, and you can register for it at louisvillesustainabilitycouncil.org. But it's fun. You can just stop by Wednesday, April 10th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cafe at Paristown. Now, also happening on Wednesday the 10th at 6:30 p.m., it's a Metro Council District 6 Candidate Forum featuring J.P. Lininger, Kate Dittmeyer-Holm, and Philip Baker. It's at 6:30 on Wednesday at Kentucky Shakespeare's headquarters in right near Central Park at 616 Myrtle Street in Old Louisville. Let's get to Thursday, April 11th at 1 p.m. The UofL Grawemeyer Award for World Order from 2024 will be giving a lecture, and that is Netta Crawford. And this is taking place in UofL's Ekstrom Library down in the basement Chow Auditorium. Dr. Crawford is a Montague Burton Chair in International Relations and Professorial Fellow at Balliol College at Oxford University. And she will be discussing her book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, which came out in 2022 from MIT Press. In this book, she explains how the U.S. military's dependence on fossil fuels and consequent need to defend the sources of those fuels leads to a cycle of demand, consumption, militarization, and conflict. She also explains how the Pentagon has reduced substantially its dependence on fossil fuels, but can do so much more to make life on our planet sustainable. She will take questions from the audience following her presentation. The event is free and open to the public. It is Thursday the 11th, 1 to 2:30 p.m. in the basement auditorium of Ekstrom Library. Learn more at louisville.edu/sustainability. Now, in the evening on Thursday, April 11th, it is the Gospel of Peace with Reverend John Deere at 7 p.m. at the Earth and Spirit Center, 1924 Newburgh Road. Join us for an evening talk and book signing with peace activist, author, and Nobel Prize nominee Reverend John Deere, D-E-A-R, as he talks about his new book, The Gospel of Peace, a commentary on Matthew, Mark, and Luke from the perspective of nonviolence. John Deere has been working for justice and disarmament and teaching peace and nonviolence for over four decades. The author of 40 books, he is executive director of the Beatitude Center, where he hosts and offers virtual talks on peacemaking. This is sponsored by the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University and the Passionist Earth and Spirit Center. It's free. No registration is required. You can learn more and you can RSVP at merton.org/DEAR. And that is Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Earth and Spirit Center. Now, Friday, April 12th at noon online, it's a community meeting to discuss the next steps for the Regional Priority Climate Action Plan. As you heard earlier on this program, Louisville Metro's Office of Sustainability has been working on and now submitted a Priority Climate Action Plan as the first phase of the EPA's Climate Pollution Reduction Grant. They appreciated everyone who participated in a variety of ways and helped shape this plan. And the final version can now be accessed at louisvilleky.gov/sustainability. Well, the next step now is that their project team is developing the second phase of the EPA grant application, the implementation plan. Metro will host a virtual community meeting on Friday, April 12th at noon to discuss next steps for the Regional Priority Climate Action Plan. You can learn more and register at louisvilleky.gov/sustainability. Coming up on Saturday, April 13th, you can join Change Today, Change Tomorrow for the State of Black Food Summit from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at UofL Health Equities Innovation Hub there at 515 West Market Street. Join us for a groundbreaking event, the State of Black Food Summit, focused on addressing food security and justice for Black families. This transformative summit brings together Black individuals, community leaders, and organizations passionate about creating equitable access to healthy and culturally relevant food. Engage in thought-provoking discussions, collaborative exercises, and networking opportunities with like-minded individuals. Explore innovative solutions, best practices, and policies to combat food insecurity in the Black community. Together, we will develop concrete action plans and strategies to drive lasting change. So you can be part of this movement to empower and uplift Black families as we envision a future where food security is a fundamental right for all. Reserve your spot now. Be part of this empowering and inspiring event. Free transportation and childcare are available. You can register on Eventbrite and you can find the link at change-today.org. Now, also coming up on Saturday, April 13th, it is the Louisville Grows Seeds and Start Sale taking place at their greenhouse at 1639 Portland Avenue from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It is the first of two spring Seeds at Start sales. Next one will be on May 11th. These sales will be filled with all of your favorite and unique veggies, herbs, fruit trees, berries, pollinator-friendly flowers, and other gardening needs. Louisville Grows, of course, is a nonprofit located in the Portland neighborhood, and proceeds from the sale of plants and other gardening items at the Seeds and Start sales directly support a sustainable and equitable food system in our community by benefiting community gardens and orchards through Louisville Grows' grant and Giving Grove programs. You can learn more at seedsandstarts.org, but just show up between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Saturday, April 13th at 1639 Portland Avenue. Saturday, April 13th is also Tree Fest in Louisville from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. This year out at Petersburg Park, 5008 East Indian Trail. Tree Fest Louisville is Louisville's annual Arbor Day celebration that provides community members with information on the roles trees play in our lives through creative, informative, and fun-filled activities and events for people of all ages. This year, we will engage volunteers to plant and mulch trees in Petersburg Park, as well as offer family-friendly activities, eco-friendly vendor booths, a tree giveaway, and the opportunity to learn from different green organizations in our city. Live music, food, and drinks are also available. It's going to be an ideal afternoon to sit in a park and take in the scenery. Don't miss it. Come on out. Enjoy the fun. More information is at treeslouisville.org/treefest. Now, also Saturday, April 13th, Brightside is hosting a sweep and sip event. They're family-friendly, rain or shine, dress for the weather, bring a water bottle, and afterward, you can get your green Brightside Mug Club mug as their way of saying thank you for your time and effort. So come on out this Saturday to Gallant Fox Brewing Company, 2132 Frankfort Avenue, at 11 a.m. for a day of cleaning on the day of Brightside's community-wide cleanup. They will be briefing all volunteers and distributing supplies. Everything is free. It's at 11 a.m. Saturday the 13th at Gallant Fox on Frankfort Avenue. And then on Sunday the 14th, join them at Old Louisville Brewery, 625 West Magnolia Avenue at 2 p.m. on Sunday for a continuation of the weekend of cleanups. As always, supplies and instructions will be provided. You can learn more and register at brightsideinc.org. And on Monday, April 15th at noon, there's going to be a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Metzl, author of Dying of Whiteness, in U of L's Kornhauser Library Auditorium downtown, 540 South Preston Street. U of L's Health Science Center Office for Diversity and Inclusion, in partnership with the School of Medicine, is hosting Dr. Jonathan Metzl, who's an author, psychiatrist, and professor at Vanderbilt University. He'll be on campus in the Kornhauser Auditorium to discuss health equity, mental health, race, society, gun violence, and other topics explored in his writings and research. It's a free event, open to all, with options to attend in person or virtually. But registration is required. You can find the link at events.louisville.edu. And lastly, I want to let you know that also Monday evening, April 15th, it's a screening of Blue Vinyl at the Passionist Earth and Spirit Center on Newburgh Road, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Join Earth Advocates and Beyond Plastics Louisville for a free screening of Blue Vinyl, an Emmy Award-winning documentary uncovering the environmental health and environmental justice impacts of vinyl chloride. It's a cancer-causing chemical used to make polyvinyl chloride, also known as PVC or vinyl. And it is found in PVC pipes, vinyl siding, windows, flooring, packaging, furniture, car parts, toys, shower curtains, credit cards, gift cards, and many other consumer goods. Toxic vinyl chloride is being carted around the country on America's rail system. And when vinyl chloride burns in train derailments like we saw in East Palestine, Ohio, it threatens the health of the surrounding community as well as first responders and workers tasked with cleaning up. After learning about the hazards it presents, you can find out how to take action and urge the EPA to ban vinyl chloride forever. Coming out this Monday, April 15th, 6:30 p.m. at the Passionist Earth and Spirit Center, 1924 Newburgh Road. You can learn more on facebook.com/groups/beyondplasticLOUKY. And that's all the time we have for today here on Sustainability Now. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting the station during our pledge drive this week. Go to fordradio.org, chip in whatever you can, and I look forward to seeing you Saturday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Logan Street Market to celebrate our 7th birthday with Charles Booker speaking. We're going to have some of our friends from our sister city station over at East Leeds Community Radio. We're going to have birthday cake and dancing, you know, fantastic silent auction. You won't want to miss it. Come on out. See you this Saturday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Logan Street Market, everyone. Be well.
Guadira, Guantanamera.